Price. Welcome to A Country Breakfast on RN. Later on this morning, inadvertently teaching old dogs new tricks, making the job of a wild dog trapper nigh on impossible.
You get these educated dogs, the ones that, you know, are trap shy, step around your traps. It's usually an aged dog. It can come, and it does happen a lot, say 75% of the time, from poor trapping techniques. Another ones they see too many of their mates caught. Like, their instinct to survive is phenomenal, and this has been going for hundreds of years. So they've seen three or four of their mates get trapped, and then all of a sudden these new smells and what's going on, and that's a bad area. And the aged dogs, and they learn.
Stalking the cunning old dogs, coming up. So on A Country Breakfast, let's find out what's been making news this week, and a very good morning to Tony Allen.
Yes, Libby, and a very busy week it has been too. I think the biggest rural story of the week, one that has been watched internationally, is the decision by the Western Australian Supreme Court to reject a case brought by an organic farmer, Steve Marsh, from Kojonup in Western Australia. He tried to sue his neighbour, Michael Baxter, another farmer, for $85,000 after contaminated canola, that is GM canola, genetically modified canola, blew onto his property. It cost Mr. Marsh his organic certification, and he sued Mr. Baxter for $85,000. But the judge in the case, and there were a lot of protests outside the court and a lot of interest in this, rejected the case, and Mr. Baxter won. Andrew Wiedemann, the chairman of Grain Producers Australia, has his own farm in Western Victoria. He grows GM crops himself. He says the court verdict provides certainty for farmers, and he's relieved that what he calls the anti-farming lobby has not won.
They've been vindicated in terms of growing the crop. The supply chain has had fazans. It's looked after all of the concerns around food that we grow for people. And I think all of those bodies have been vindicated in the way that they've gone about providing growers with choice in regards to the crop types that they grow today.
It's actually really quite a complicated issue because we have zero tolerance of GM in legislation, don't we?
Yes, what the judge found was that zero tolerance of genetically modified material in organics was unjustifiable. Now, to get your crop certified as organic, which means you can sell it for a higher price and get access to a pretty premium market, you need a certification in Australia from NASA. Now, that's not the space agency, it's the National Association for Sustainable Agriculture. And it's come into the spotlight a little bit over this case. It removed Mr. Marsh's organic status from some of his farm, and the organisation is saying it did not act too harshly in doing so. Ben Copeman from NASA says, in fact, the organisation itself was not responsible for harming Mr. Marsh's business.
No, not at all. Steve would totally agree with the decision we made, as would 100% of the organic industry. And the thing that you have to remember, too, is that the tolerance levels are not set by NASA. The tolerance levels are set by the federal government in the National Standard for Organic and Biodynamic Produce, and that is administered by the Department of Agriculture.
And this is really creating some interesting discussion about whether or not we really do need the zero tolerance.
Yeah, well, Professor Rick Rausch from Melbourne University has looked at the issue of genetically modified crops around the world in some detail, and he says this particular argument that organic crops should have no GM material in them whatsoever is actually unique to Australia because our zero tolerance is not demanded by anybody else.
In other countries, there is a tolerance for very small levels of legally approved genetically modified seeds or pollen or whatever to be found in a crop, even in organics. In the United States, for example, there is broad-scale examples of GM and organic crops being grown in close proximity, including, in fact, in some farming operations in the United States, the same farmer will be using both GM and organic production.
It's certainly zero tolerance of GMs in South Australia.
Well, Tasmania too. The two states that reject genetically modified crops at the moment, Tasmania and South Australia, will be very interested in this decision. And South Australia made no doubt where it stood last weekend when the Agriculture Minister attended a protest against genetically modified food. Now, South Australia is the only mainland state where you can't grow GM crops. And the Minister, Leon Bignall, rejected a lot of criticism that he received, not only from fellow politicians, but also from some farm groups about attending this so-called March Against Monsanto in Adelaide.
I've been a campaigner against GM for 8 years. I grew up on a dairy farm. I understand what farming's all about, and I also understand what the export business is all about, and we can do a lot better by being GM-free than by introducing GM here.
And the company that produces the GM seed, Monsanto, is not impressed. Adam Blight from Monsanto says the company was disappointed that the minister joined the rally.
Monsanto is a company whose products are used by tens of thousands of farmers across Australia each year, including in South Australia. So we were disappointed to see a minister marching against a company that has been working in Australian agriculture for more than 60 years.
Now, when you mention the word cartel, you don't really think eggs.
No, but the Australian Egg Corporation and two large egg companies are being taken to court by the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. They allegedly colluded in 2010 and 2012 to limit the supply of eggs to prevent the supply, the price falling. Now, the egg industry itself is gone very quiet over this, doesn't want to comment, but the ACCC says it's a very important case to make sure that there's no cartel operating in the egg industry and customers are getting a fair price for their eggs. And some free-range producers say, well, we're not colluding in any market and we'd like this investigation to go ahead. One of them is Meg Parkinson from Victoria. She says she welcomes the ACCC's investigation.
The ACCC is working not only in the egg industry but for a whole lot of industries and trying to sort out cartel behaviour, market manipulation. And I think that will be good for consumers, but I think it will also be good for all those players in the industry who are just doing their best to make a living for their families. I think it will help all of us as well.
And Tony, this week another live animal export market reopened.
This week in Parliament, the Agriculture Minister Barnaby Joyce announced that trade to Iran would resume, that protocols had been agreed with Iran to do so, including Australia's SCAS supply system, which he said would ensure animal welfare. Now, Iran is a very large country, big population, a lot of wealth and a lot of demand for livestock, and Australia sees this as sort of the holy grail of live exports. And we haven't exported sheep to Iran since the late 1970s, when a boycott was imposed following the Islamic Revolution there. So the Australian government and live exporters are very excited, but welfare groups say they're still not happy with the welfare of animals that might be sent to Iran. RSPCA Australia's Heather Neal says the SCAS system does not guarantee that animals will be treated well.
I think there's enough examples with SCAS going terribly wrong and the government doing really very little in order to bring exporters into line and to take away their licences when they're shown time and time again to be getting it wrong.
Now, Tony, the Nationals are revolting, slight exaggeration, but not happy with suggestions that quarantine in government should be merged with the what's called the Australian Border Force.
Yes, this goes back to the big announcement by the government to merge immigration and customs and so on into the huge Australian Border Force, an overarching body to protect our borders. It does save the government some money in the budget, but it's also aimed at strengthening our border security. Now, one of the other things that has been linked to customs is biosecurity, quarantine in other words. And the ABC has learned that some cabinet ministers wanted biosecurity rolled into this border force as well as a way of cutting spending. No final decision has been made, and the government is saying through Barnaby Joyce that he won't do anything to compromise Australia's quarantine status. The National Farmers Federation is also very concerned about the concept, says the idea is dumb. And Nationals MP Andrew Broad, who's a former president of the Victorian Farmers Federation, says the idea should be rejected out of hand.
You don't control foot and mouth disease and keep that out of our border with a gun. It's something that needs to be done with an agricultural focus. We've got great border security and we've got great quarantine and I think they are very different in their function and they need to be maintained that way.
And one of the biggest guns to join the debate is a Nobel laureate, Professor Peter Doherty. He's an immunologist at Melbourne University, world famous, and he says that if you rolled biosecurity into border protection, you could threaten both animal and human health in Australia.
Biosecurity has much more of a science base, in fact, because you're looking for things like organisms contaminating the bottom of ships and possible incursion of viruses like foot and mouth disease virus, which are not going to show up on the borders very likely. If they do get in, they'll be somewhere inland.
Well, still talking science in a sense and diseases, the CSIRO research sites, some of them are going to be closed.
The budget cut CSIRO funding by $111 million, and that is likely to have some repercussions for regional CSIRO research sites. In New South Wales, it's believed that the Irrigation Research Laboratory at Griffith in the Riverina and the MOPRA Telescope near Coonabarabran are going to be closed down, and the CSIRO's liquid fuels research could also close. The CSIRO Staff Association President Michael Borges says they are particularly surprised by the closure of the Griffith Laboratory.
So we're really working hard to try and support the staff there. We have a very strong view on the need to maintain regional labs, to maintain connection with the broadest cross-section of the Australian community. So the closure of the Griffiths Labs is particularly disappointing.
And Tony, the sales of nuts are set to go nuts.
They are. If you like nuts, as I do, you might be aware that a lot of people are catching on to them because they are healthy snacks. And the nut industry held a meeting. I don't know what you'd use for the collective noun of nuts, but they were all there.
Nutters, of course.
Nutters. A whole group of nutters had a conference in Melbourne to discuss the future of their industry, and they were very, very optimistic. They were told that within a decade we'd be exporting $1 billion worth of nuts a year. The nut crop itself could be 44% bigger by 2025, and the profits of farmers from growing nuts could go up 80% or so. And the chairman of the Australian Nut Industry Council, Richard Sampson-Genet, says it's international and local demand for nuts like almonds, pistachios and macadamias, all growing as their health benefits are promoted.
We just see that the consumption of nuts worldwide is really still at the start of the curve. We can see dramatic increases going forward from here. The health message, which has been promulgated the last 10 years or so, which has revealed that the nut composition or the oil composition of nuts is extraordinarily healthy. They've got a fabulous range of vitamins and minerals.
Well, it's official the drought's over in some of the shires in North Queensland, but farmers certainly don't agree.
Well, it's just the Gulf area, the Carpentaria, Doomadgee and Berkshires that have been declared out of drought. Now, you would think that's a very good thing, but it means that farmers in the area are no longer eligible for drought assistance, and 75% of Queensland is still officially drought declared. Grazier Annie Clark from the Berkshire says the decision to declare her area drought-free is premature.
I just wouldn't call it anywhere near our normal Gulf wet season. I'm certainly wondering what sort of investigations go on in relation to the lifting of the drought. Have they taken all of the variables into consideration? I just think that people are going to need sustained support for quite a while to get through this patch.
Now, this is a really concerning story, isn't it, that the Pacific Islands could run out of fish?
Yes, the warning has come in the prelude to a meeting in Samoa next month where Pacific Island nations are going to talk about management of tuna fisheries. Now, the 60% of the world's tuna is in the Pacific, but there's every chance the Pacific Island nations are not going to be the ones who eat it. Fisheries researcher Dr. Quentin Hannick heads up an Australian aid program to help Pacific Islanders manage their fish stocks as they challenge things like population pressure, climate change and a lot of foreign fishing boats. And he says that some of the boats are big enough, they have such large capacity as they could completely remove the tuna stocks.
Some of the world's biggest fishing boats from Spain, 500 feet long. When you manage that fishery, you need to obviously make it sustainable. But then you've also got to start prioritising where you want to feed. If you need to worry about food security for a small island country that doesn't have many other opportunities, you need to prioritise what you can feed them.
Now, next we're talking what concerts.
An Alice Springs nutritionist has been inspired by the cooking competitions on television to go into remote Indigenous communities, try and get people excited about cooking healthy food. Roy Price is his name. He travels around Australia with woks and with stoves made out of old flour drums. And he says cooking in these things, and it's a mixture of learning and competition, and it's drawing big crowds.
They've been talked to by doctors and nurses and nutritionists, and they watch things on TV, they watch videos. They know and understand what they need to be is engaged in the process. I can honestly say from about 60 of these events that I've conducted, all of them have gone off like a U2 concert.
Dear. First of all, it was the pub with no beer. Now it's the pumpkin festival with no pumpkins.
The Goomari Pumpkin Festival last weekend, for the first time, had to import pumpkins, which isn't very good for a town famous for its pumpkins, but they had to get 600 Jap pumpkins from Brisbane in order to have enough to stage their famous, two famous events, the pumpkin roll and the pumpkin shot put. Don't ask me how far they shot put they putted the pumpkin, but I imagine it wasn't that far. Organisers are Jeff Stunn, which that's his name, Jeff Stunn, says the recent dry and last year's floods combined to cause the pumpkin shortage.
We only got rain in the last 6 weeks, and there was a few irrigated pumpkins here, but not many, and so we had to bring in the rollers from Brisbane. It is actually the first time we try to use local growers, but with the floods and that, a couple of them have gone out of business, and there weren't enough really to go in.
You've got to have enough pumpkins to go around if you're going to roll them, don't you?
Yes, or put them.
Or put them.
Thank you.
Where do you put your pumpkins?
Thank you for putting pumpkins, Tony Allen. Tony Allen with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
This animal sounds like nothing you've ever heard before. It's a cross between a frothing cappuccino machine and a squealing pig.
What is it? And why is it screaming out like that? Turns out, this animal is interested in real estate and sex. Let me, Anne Jones, translate the natural world for you. Off Track, this afternoon at 1, here on RN.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, young Aboriginal shearers swap the dusty outback of Brewarrina for the salty air of Bruny Island in chilly Tasmania. The community comes together to roast chestnuts in Hoskinstown, and we get a sneak peek inside historic Boobagin Homestead in southeast Queensland. It's been in the Lawless family for six generations. We're also off to Adelaide for an unusual medieval wine tasting event. It's a humorous take on the popular television series Game of Thrones.
You know, wine, it's a social lubricant. It makes, it's fun, you know. You get have a few drinks and you enjoy yourself. It's, and it is actually possible to learn about wine and enjoy yourself at the same time.
Grenache. Louder, James!
Blind wine tastings in torture chambers coming up a bit later. But let's start today with a new generation of young Aboriginal shearers being put through their paces in southern Tasmania.
Good man. Step over. Yeah. Keep up. Straight out. Beautiful blow.
Beautiful windswept Bruny Island off the southeast coast of Tasmania is a world away from their homes in the dusty outback of New South Wales. You can smell the salt in the air and there's a stiff breeze blowing up from the sea. But it's an opportunity of a lifetime for eight young Indigenous trainees working in the shearing shed.
What we're doing now is going to load a bale into the press. Anyone put a pack in the press before?
Yeah.
That's good.
G'day, I'm James Eustam. These teenagers are partway through a special 15-week training and employment program that's being run through the Indigenous Land Corporation, which owns both Merriman Station near Brewarrina and Murrayfield here on Bruny Island. It's hoped the skills they learn here from people like Laurie Bateman will hold them in good stead when they're looking for work in shearing teams around the country and the world.
today it's all about going through the paces. Shearing is one of those things where, well, like most things in life, you never stop learning.
What sort of outcomes are you looking for these kids after the training and with the training to do in the future?
We're targeting an industry, the shearing industry, that's looking for youth. So any one of these kids have got an opportunity to go into the shearing workforce all over Australia. And we've also got connections in New Zealand with the Maoris. And we've also been sending young Aboriginal kids across the Tasman. And likewise, they've been coming back to us as well.
That's a lovely bale. And you read there, see it says there, maximum bale length of 1.25, and that's because of shipping on the truck.
What's your name, mate?
Duncan Andrews.
And where are you from?
Coonabarabran. Oh, well, I'm 19, yeah.
What's it been like, the journey down to Tassie, from being up north?
Oh, it's different. The sheep are rougher down there. Sheep are heaps smoother down here, not as many wrinkles. Yeah, heaps are hotter. It's cold down here. Yeah, all you see is dust out there. We done a bit before we come here, back in Bray Warrener, but here the sheep are a bit straighter, starting to get our blows right. And yeah, it's good. Yeah, lucky to be down here.
My name is Georgie Rangi Hayata. I'm the wool handling trainer for Merriman's Shearing School.
There couldn't be too many better sheds with a view like this around, could there?
Well, picture this, guys. You're looking straight out the shed. And there is the ocean right in front of us in the mainland, which must be Tasmania or Hobart. And we're only probably about 100 yards, maybe, to the beach. You know, that's every morning. It's a bit of a, luxury down here. We just love it.
A bit of a unique experience for the kids as well, isn't it?
Well, it was really for eight of these kids. You know, they come from Bree Warrener, Gadooga, Lightning Ridge, and Coonabarabran, I think it is. And what happened, you know, for a few of them, it was their first time on the plane from Dubbo to Sydney, so we had to wait there for a couple of hours and fly out from Sydney to Hobart. So I had to make sure my passengers were okay, weren't seasick or whatever.
Why is it important for them to come down here and experience a different environment and a different setting for them as well?
Well, you know, in the shearing industry, a lot of shearers travel all over the world. It's not just in their home area. And I believe it's really important for the young teenagers to get out of the country, you know, like out of Bourke or Bree Warren or Gadooga, just to open their mind a bit more, network with other shearing contractors or even shearers or wool handlers. So when they finish their course, you know, it's a 15-week course, they're ready to go straight into work.
Everyone happy with that?
Yeah. Watch your hands.
Fingers.
Watch your hands. Fingers out.
I'm Bruce Michael, manager of Murrayfield on Bruny Island. This is the first time we've had these kids come down from Merriman, and we're pretty excited once we've seen the quality of these young people coming through. There's a lot of good reasons to keep these young people in the shearing industry.
How important are these opportunities and this training for Indigenous kids to build a career in the future?
The shearing industry is where you'll learn life skills, and that's what these kids will do. Not only do they get a job in being employed in the wool industry, but actually they learn life skills, you know, getting up in the morning, making sure that they obey all the rules that go with a shearing team. So just the basic things, like making sure that you shower properly, you keep your room tidy, you keep the bathroom and the toilets all clean, you help the cook out at the evenings, and those sort of things which are not related to shearing, but they're related to good life skills. You know, it's how to look after yourself, how to look after your body, how to keep yourself fit and healthy. Even if they don't stay in the shearing industry, it's something that they'll keep with them.
Just come around the back here. Just make sure when you put this down, it's got the safety device here that stops the handle from opening. Make sure that's forward. Sometimes if it's just around here, that lever there won't catch it, and it can if you just bump it, the bloody press will come undone.
All right, mate. So what's your name?
Thomas.
Where are you from and how old are you?
I'm from Lightning Ridge and I'm 15.
And what are you doing right now?
Oh, I'm just cleaning the handpiece and taking the comb and cutters off.
What do you like about being down here and shearing?
Oh, it's just to get away from the place and that and just come working, earn a bit of money.
Is this something you want to do as a career in the future?
I'd like to be a really good shearer when I'm older.
There's a fair bit of wool stuck in those blades as well, so we'll let you keep cleaning them out.
Yeah, okay.
One of the challenges that I can see with young people going into the industry is they need to travel. Our areas where we predominantly are sheep, they're shrinking. Saying that, there's still heaps of sheep around, and the challenge is that they can, that they want to leave home and go and travel around and have a look around Australia and the country. There's 27 countries where they can go to work. It's if they want to do it, it's all there for them.
Bella, bella, bella.
And the thing I do near the end, give them a good whack. And that helps them become a bit more easy to peel for everybody.
As the days get cooler and the leaves on the trees have well and truly changed colour, it's the sign that the chestnut season has begun. And they're celebrating that fact here in this tiny village called Hoskinstown on the southern tablelands of New South Wales, about a 45-minute drive from Canberra. Hello, I'm Lucy Barber at the annual Chestnut Roast Festival, where local growers Heather and John Kane are busy roasting and serving their chestnuts to plenty of hungry visitors.
John, you're roasting some chestnuts here. What's the process you're going through there?
What we've got is a charcoal fire underneath. We're heating the chestnuts up on the rounded side, which is cut first, and then we do that for 5 minutes, then we turn them over onto the flat side, and that helps the chestnut just open up like an oyster. They're running at about 400 degrees heat on the pan at the moment, but they're, and so I'll steam them out with keeping the lid on so that they don't dry out and so they don't lose their moisture, and it'll take up to 20, 25 minutes to roast them right through.
If you stand here long enough, you sort of get a chestnut facial, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Everybody smells you walking around the markets. People can't see us often, but they can smell us. It's a lovely odour, roast chestnuts on a charcoal fire. Once here.
So you cooked them before?
Yeah, I used to have a tree in my backyard.
You're happy with that?
I had lots of prickles.
Prickles go with the territory, yeah.
A few years ago, the Hoskinstown community used to always run an annual car boot sale. We offered the community a chance to do something quite unique by suggesting that we bring the chestnuts down here. So we changed the timing of the community fundraising event to coincide with the harvest. And I think the crowds demonstrate that they actually think it's pretty good to come and try a roast chestnut. There's a pretty big queue there for those roast chestnuts. The boys are working really hard. My name's Heather Kane and I'm a chestnut grower from Hoskinstown. John started planting chestnuts in 1997, so that's about 17 years now.
Do you think most people know what a chestnut tree looks like?
No, most have absolutely no idea, and I'm constantly answering questions as to how do you harvest them, where do they come from. So
where do chestnuts come from?
The variety that we grow, it's a European variety. It's believed they probably came into Australia in the 1850s with the immigrants that came in for the gold rushes. And since that time, various ones have been selected for their taste and appeal to people.
And what does a chestnut tree look like?
Oh, it can be a very tall tree. It can be 30 metres tall. It can have very elegant branches, a little bit like the size of a walnut tree, that sort of thing. Nice, long, serrated green leaves. The trees flower in November, and then the burr with fruit starts to develop through that summer period. So February, you can start to see which burrs will hold a productive fruit.
So how do you harvest them?
You have to wait until the nuts fall to the ground, and you either then pick them up by hand or nowadays we have some harvesters that help to sweep and vacuum up the nuts and burrs. We've just finished harvesting our chestnuts and we start in mid-March and go through, say, to early May.
I think the thing about chestnuts, I know for me, is that you just think, oh, what do I do with them?
You can do countless things. You're limited by your imagination. You need to initially cook the chestnut and peel it, and then you can make soups, purees, which you can sweeten and use in desserts, a chocolate mousse with a chestnut puree and it's fantastic. You can roast the chestnuts, eat them as is, combine them with caramel. It's limitless, really.
But you've got to remember to slice them, do a crisscross across the top, don't you?
It's really important to score that skin before you dry cook them, particularly. Otherwise, they will explode.
Happens at once here.
I'd like to see an exploding chestnut. Sounds like fun. We don't really want that to happen, though, do we? Chestnut grower Heather Kane giving Lucy Barber some cooking tips at the Hoskinstown Chestnut Festival. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, Adelaide's Game of Rones Wine Festival, and we step inside historic Boobergen Homestead.
The bells were designed for different animals. Some of them would have been for bullocks, some of them maybe for draft horses, some of them might be for sheep or goats or cows or whatever. And the point is that on a very foggy or maybe before it's light on in the morning, you were chasing the house cow around the paddock. You didn't want to be following this when you should have been following that.
These old cowbells are welcoming you to the historic Boobergen Homestead, a heritage-listed pioneer property near the small town of Gameri in southeast Queensland. It's been in the Lawless family since the original settler brothers arrived from Ireland in 1847, and current owners, Stephanie and Michael Lawless, are the sixth generation to live here. Hello, I'm Eliza Rogers, and I've joined Stephanie on the veranda near some very noisy ducks to find out what makes this 167-year-old homestead so special.
It's special because it's unique. It's really hard to describe this to anyone because there isn't anything else like it. This is a very early pioneer homestead, and a lot of things that you see here you really don't see anywhere else. The fact that the family is still living here is unusual in itself.
Just describe the layout to me, because I understand it's basically five buildings attached by roofs and verandas.
Yeah, the homestead was built originally as one building. In those days, it was just, you know, probably one or two rooms where the brothers lived originally, and then the brothers went back one by one and married, and when they came back, they had to build on another building for a nursery. Or when the women started to come here, it became important to make the place more of a home than just a house. Originally, the first building was virtually a two-room bachelor pad. When the women came here, they wanted a little more comfort than that. And so they'd build on other buildings. And really, the house grew just like Topsy. Every time they needed another room, they had a rush of blood to the head and had another building instead. And they date from different periods. The oldest one is 1848, and the newest one is between 1945 and 1950.
What are some of the special, unique items in this house, special to you?
Everything. The fact that it's built mostly of ironbark slabs, and we have ironbark shingles on the roof of one of the buildings. We lost them off two of the others during a storm in the 1970s. But you can see very much what this homestead was like right at the beginning. And I'm sure if Ellen Lawless, who was the first Mrs. Lawless, came back here, she would feel quite at home. She would recognise what she was in. And that's a very special thing, and not something many people get to experience. But there are lots of old artefacts, things that were used on the property throughout its life. And some of these things that look really old and antique-y, we still actually use. But there's old brands, there's lots of old books and games and things which we love. Terribly hard to get the housework done when you do those. You tend to find something and interesting and start reading it or playing with it, and it's all over after that. And there are paintings, and there's furniture, some very beautiful furniture that we're very fond of, but we don't feel like we actually own this. It's something that we're looking after.
Will it carry on? You have three children. Are there plans for any of them to come out and live here?
Not specific plans, but all of them are aware of the importance of maintaining the history, and they certainly want to take the property on, or have said that they do, and we hope that this happens too. And I would love to think that somebody will be caring for the house, but I don't wish that job on any of them, really. It's not an easy house to care for. A lot of people come here and say, oh, I wished I lived here. And you really have to be careful what you wish for, because it's not always an easy house to live in. On the other hand, in some ways, it's a very easy house to live in. Whatever the shortcomings these people were as house builders, they knew how to pick a spot. We have a magnificent view. And this house, although it was built by young men from Ireland who probably hadn't had much to do with building before, built a house that was totally in tune with the climate. The rooms here, you can open a lot of them up from one side to the other. It means you get a lovely, you can create drafts through those rooms and around the corners. We live on our verandas in the summer because they're such comfortable places to be. And in the winter, you have to close up the house. We have two fireplaces and, yeah, we do huddle over those in the winter because it does get very cold here for a short time in the winter. And you can go and sit in sun traps and take your work to the places where there's no wind but nice sunshine. And in a lot of those ways, it does rather better than a lot of modern houses.
Last question. I'm not sure how superstitious you are, but have you ever had any spiritual encounters in this house?
Well, up until recently, I would have said no, I hadn't personally, although there have been occasions when people have seen things here that turned out later to have not been here. I often hear, and have done in the past, the steps of people on the veranda, and I've thought that my husband or my son was walking up the veranda, and when I've gone out, there was nobody there. I like to think that might be Grandpa or Uncle Burnett, or maybe not, I don't know. But as long as they're happy here and that they're happy with us being here, I don't have a problem with that. It's a family house. It's been here for a long time. People have lived here. People have died here. People have been born here. And I'd be quite disappointed if after all this time they were all gone.
Yeah.
I hope that they are happy with what we're doing to the house now and the way we're living in it.
Grenache.
Louder.
Grenache.
Louder.
Grenache.
Louder, James!
Grenache!
What we're listening to is a blind wine tasting in a torture chamber. Most would think the concept was a bit absurd, but to the 300 people here at Adelaide's Game of Rones wine event, it makes perfect sense.
Drink now while you have the chance.
Hello, I'm Danielle Grindley. Welcome to a brand new world of wine marketing here in South Australia. Today's festival is a humorous take on the popular television series Game of Thrones. Winemakers and guests have been encouraged to dress up in medieval costume, serving and tasting grape varieties that are grown in the Rhone Valley region of France. For creator Dan Sims, it's all about turning pompous wine events into enjoyable days out.
So the torture chamber is like the blind tasting torture chamber, but to make it a bit fun, and you can hear the music in the background, and we have the red woman with us today who is you've got to guess what the wine is, but you're quite distracted, so to speak. I've been involved in the wine game for way too long, probably about 15, 20 years, but generally working in restaurants. So I just come from a sommelier background, and I suppose I saw this, little gap that so many wine events are focused on the top 5% of wine consumers, and when no one was actually talking to people who drink every day, or they'd go to an event and they were boring. They were just those seriously masterclasses, or they were just too focused on the high end. But you know, wine, it's a social lubricant. It's fun. You know, you get have a few drinks and you enjoy yourself. It is actually possible to learn about wine and enjoy yourself at the same time.
I understand mixing up the theme and attracting a different crowd. Game of Thrones.
I'm a massive fan of the show, obviously, but it was I was with a friend, very creative friend, and he's not into wine, and we were having a few drinks, funnily enough, drinking some wines from the Rhone, and he's like, "Oh mate, you've got to do a Game of Rhones," and I was like, "Yes." So we started like talking and brainstorming, as said, social lubricant, and hence Game of Rhones was born, and it just resonated with people, and especially with producers. And it's ridiculous, I think, just to have a bit of fun, like, and just having a bit of it's a bit of fun, very much tongue-in-cheek.
How important is that to create a connection between the grower and the consumer?
Hugely, absolutely. It's incredibly important because people want to have that connection. They want to buy their produce, they want to look at the farmer in the eye and purchase it. And story sells everything. Like I said, I come from a sommelier background, and I've only ever sold wine to a customer or on style and story. I've never sold it on Baume levels or TA levels or acid levels or malolactic fermentation, all these stupid words that we use in the wine game because we understand it, but most people, it's just gobbledygook.
Out here in the main hall, producers are lined up with their wares on display. McLaren Vale winemaker Roland Short isn't dressed up in costume today, but he's happy to embrace this new way of marketing his product.
Well, we're not allowed to be technical. We get a blue card if we say anything technical about the wine, but we can talk about just the feel of McLaren Vale, how it's a wonderful community, a family of great growers that we all help each other out.
Does it frustrate you sometimes that quality isn't enough, that you do have to give this story and create a product?
Oh, yes, we do. Having good wine is not enough. There's a lot of good wine, so then it's about the story and how you can differentiate yourself from the person just down the road.
Sam Barry is a third generation winemaker from the Clare Valley. He's not sure his father or grandfather would appreciate the Game of Rhones concept as much as he does.
What these events create is a new interest. They're not talking to the same people. They're talking to a new generation of wine consumers who are interested in wine but don't want to go to the serious wine events. Game of Thrones is hot right now, and looking forward to the Breaking Bad wine event.
Unbeknownst to him, James Butcher from Adelaide guessed the exact vintage and variety of wine he tasted in the torture chamber.
It was the most interesting glass of wine I've ever had, I think. I think normally you have to pay a premium price for that sort of experience. It's quite enjoyable, I have to say.
Wine is coming.
I'd hate to think what would have happened if he got it wrong. Adelaide resident James Butcher, a happy customer at the Game of Rhones wine tasting event. Thanks to Danielle Grinlay for that story. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Coming up, inadvertently teaching old dogs new tricks.
Have you caught up with RN's digital magazine? The white paper brings a new dimension to your enjoyment of RN. Great articles, audio and video to play with. And this month we celebrate the Sydney Writers' Festival, from the ethics of true crime with John Safran to the making of that TV classic Breaking Bad with Vince Gilligan, and favourites like Benjamin and Michelle Law, Richard Flanagan, Christina Olsen. It's RN's white paper. It's free and you can subscribe from our homepage.
Now, it's hard to imagine how a much-loved family pet, the dog, can be so vilified. But once a dog is born in the bush and joins a feral pack, it's a killer. Wild dogs are costing farmers hundreds of millions of dollars in killing and maiming sheep and even cattle. While some states are dropping poison bait from helicopters in the high country, the lone wild dog trapper still seems to be the most effective control. Michael Kavanagh spoke with Roger Roche about his 6 years trapping wild dogs.
Look, you've got a multi-million dollar industry here on the Monero, and these dogs are always coming. That's never going to change. They're always moving in one way or another.
There's a wonderful quote: "It's not hard. All you have to do is find a dog in 10,000 acres of bush and get him to step on 4 square inches of steel." It's a little bit more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's right. That, sometimes it's even harder than that. Anybody can catch one dog. That's the easy part. Like I can show somebody set a trap and they can catch that one dog. It's not the one dog. At the end of the day, it's those last few. And that's what's happening in a few of the areas. You're up to your tough dogs, and they could take 10 times more time to catch than the other 40 or 50, and when you get to these tougher age dogs. So you try not to let it get to that stage. You know, you're trying to nip them in the bud. Proactive is the only way to go in this world. Like, you want to stay reactive and no one wins. It's a total disaster. Sometimes you do reactive work, but proactive programs is a way to keep the sheep and the cattle on the Monero for sure.
Roger, there was a phrase used about an educated dog and a poor trapper. What does that actually mean?
You get these educated dogs, the ones that, you know, are trap shy, step around your traps. It's usually an aged dog. It can come, and it does happen a lot, say 75% of the time, from poor trapping techniques. That's one of the ways, but it doesn't have to be like that. Sometimes you're leaving on a bit of luck, and they might put their foot on the side of the trap and their toe touch the plate, and it gets sprung. They get what they call twig, but that's just luck. You've done your best you can to catch this dog. Another ones they see too many of their mates caught. Like, their instinct to survive is phenomenal, and this has been going for hundreds of years. So they've seen three or four of their mates get trapped, and then all of a sudden these new smells and what's going on, and that's a bad area. And the aged dogs, and they learn. Can be poor trapping technique, can be over-trapping, you know what I mean, or just that they've been there. And you can be unlucky too, you know. And some of these dogs, they're switched on, you know. Like, that's what they do. They survive, and that's why they're still there, and that's why there is a fair few of them.
You mean to say that, in fact, you can have too much trapping and the dogs learn from that?
They can, but it can be just that individual dog. He might only see a couple trapped, two or three or four trapped, and he's switched on. You walk down to the pub and you see a couple of your mates get belted on the corner in a couple of times. You're not going to go down to that corner, are you? You think, geez, I'll get a belting down there too. Same sort of scenario. You also hear that bait shy. Put it in terms, they walk past bait stations or walk past the poison, but you've gone down the street and you've already had a feed, and then there's another three or four cafes. You mightn't call in on them either, you know? So that's the same sort of thing, but the next time you might. So you've only got poison and the sort of half a dozen different techniques, and you've only got trapping, you know, and you've got a little bit of howling and shooting, but they're just all you've got in your kit bag, so that's why it makes it so hard.
Are people like you also the victim of your own success? You're a good trapper, you cleaned out an area, and therefore people think the problem's gone away, and therefore your skills weren't appreciated.
There is a lot of people that don't understand it, and I could stand in a room and try and explain it for an hour, and it'll probably go over the head of most people, you know. And it's a stupid industry, it's a stupid trade where they can't teach it anywhere, you know. And so unless you've been down this way, but it's the results that you're chasing. It's not the dog tally you're chasing, and yeah, caught 100, 200 dogs, whatever it may be. It's the results, and is there sheep available for that one? That's the way you gauge it. And I don't know about being unappreciated or whatever. I've got no idea. I just went out there and I did my job. And it'd be cruel to see that sort of country go under to the dog, but you can control them. You'll never beat these dogs. You can throw the army at those mountains and there'll be a dog walk out the other side. His build is too great. His instinct's too great, but you can't control them.
We've seen the growth in recent times of game hunting and a push to allow game hunters into parks and other areas. As a trapper, wouldn't it make your life easier?
I know the game hunting, they play their part in some areas, but they use them in Victoria, big on the deer world, they know, and this sort of stuff. I'm against it. If anything, you know, you might be feeding up. We'll just jump from sideways from dogs to pigs, you know. You might have a lot of pigs feeding, you know, and the game hunters come along and they just spread the pigs out. I'm not a fan of it myself, but, you know, I might be proven wrong later down the track. I think just a good solid program, that one operator, no fellas stepping over each other, one operator, good solid programs, and everybody working together, and they've proved it. They can work, and that's probably how I'd stick.
What about a return to the bounty system?
I don't like the idea of the bounty system. I've heard a lot of troubles in Victoria. They brought it to $100 for the fox and that, but then there's blokes that got trap lines in, and you have people running the traps and pinching dogs out of their traps. It isn't about the number of dogs you trap. It's just how you control the bush. A trap and tally, as I said, if you're chasing a trap and tally, well, if you use just traps, you'll lose. It's an integrated approach, and whatever method for that time or where you are works, that's what you do.
Former wild dog trapper Roger Roche speaking there with Michael Kavanagh. Now, if you've ever been in the middle of cooking dinner and thought, uh-oh, I've forgotten the basil, you might now be able to find some just a few blocks away in someone else's backyard. A website called Ripe Near Me has just been set up. It's basically a map which shows where backyard fruit and vegetables are available, either for free, for sale or for trade. Nikolai Balhart spoke with the co-creator of the website, Alistair Martin.
The whole idea of Ripe Near Me is it allows anyone anywhere to post produce that they grow themselves to share or give away or swap or sell. So, but more than that, it also allows other people to then subscribe to that produce. So if I've got a lemon tree, for example, in my backyard, I can post it on the map. Other people can find that. They can subscribe to my lemon tree. And as soon as those lemons are ready to go, I can change the status of the lemon listing from growing to ripe. And then all the subscribers get an email. So it cuts down on food waste. All those lemons actually get to go to good homes. And also gives me the potential to make some money if I wanted to sell the lemons or swap them for some chicken eggs or anything else.
And is that where the idea came from, that there was a fruit tree somewhere and you thought, can't let this go to waste?
Precisely, yeah, exactly right. We saw a lot of citrus about this time of year, and for some reason citrus in particular just seems to go to waste. There's so many citrus trees around Adelaide, and it falls to the ground, makes a huge mess, and it doesn't make sense when you walk into a supermarket and you see the same fruit for sale for $5, $6, $7, $8 a kilo, and half the time it's imported from overseas. So
now, you mentioned that the subscribers have the choice to either give food away or to sell it or to trade it. What's the split? I mean, are most people giving it away? Are people using it as a way of trying to supplement their income?
I hope that that's where we'll be able to get to. I think as the app grows, we're still building up the membership, obviously. And one of our long-term goals is to get to a point where a person can be in a position where perhaps they're retired or semi-retired. Maybe they're struggling to get work, but then they decide, well, hang on, I've got this backyard. Instead of downsizing, why don't I just grow a high-value crop in my backyard and supplement my income? At the moment, it's probably 50-50 between people that list it for free and people that list it for a price. And quite often when people list it for a price, they're quite happy to swap anyway. So more often than not, no money changes hands, but it's completely up to the grower and it's up to the individuals when they exchange.
Well, I think it's time for me to go and try and find some of this food. I'm going to set myself a bit of a challenge and see what I can find within a few blocks of the ABC studios here in Adelaide. Alistair Martin, thanks for having a chat and explaining it all to me.
No worries. Happy foraging.
Okay, so I've stepped out the front door of the ABC. I've probably been walking for about 10, maybe 15 minutes, but it's a nice sunny day, so that's not too bad. And I've found one spot where apparently I can pick up some excess produce. So Sarah is the name of the person I'm going to have a chat to. I hope I found the right house. I think this is the one. So we'll go and knock the door.
Hello,
Sarah, I'm Nikolai.
Hi, how are you?
How are you doing? Lovely. Good to meet you. Thanks.
Sarah says she found out about the site through an online forum and has been on it for quite a while now and has managed to get some pretty nice produce.
So far I've bought eggs from members. I've at Christmas time I got zucchini, basil. I've exchanged my excess produce with other members as well.
So it goes both ways. So you've been getting rid of some of your excess, but also finding bits and pieces that you need.
Yes, so it's like if I've got excess stuff, and if I need stuff, then there's other members on there, I'll contact them and purchase my fresh produce from other members.
Would you say you're a keen gardener as such?
I love my garden, yes. It's my little outlet.
What have you been growing?
So far at the moment, I have got broccoli, kale, spinach, peas, beans, corn's just come to an end. So I grow quite a variety of foods.
And how much of it would you say you're putting up for other people?
Maybe about 5%. And now that when I'm planting a small amount of crop just to give away to other people.
And you mentioned that you've been giving it away, because there's the option, I think, to sell, give away, or and trade. How have you been doing that?
With my own produce, I've preferred either to give it away or to trade. Produce that I've received, it's all been a combination of giveaway, trade, or purchase.
And have you found other people in this kind of area, or have you had to travel pretty far?
I found two local people, like within a 5k radius. The others I've had to travel maybe up to 15 kilometres. So compared to where your food, like the food miles from stuff from your supermarket, it's very, very good in that respect.
That's Sarah, one of the people using the website Ripe Near Me, speaking with Nikolai Balhartz. And that's all we have time for today. If you'd like to take a look at some of the photographs for today's stories or read some of the news, listen back to the show on podcast, you can do all of that on our website, abc.net.au/rural. Great to have your company this morning, and indeed for the last 18 months, thanks to our technical producer, Matthew Sigley. This is my last show on RN, and indeed my last broadcast on the ABC after nearly 30 years with Auntie. I'm now off to Benalla in northeast Victoria, quite literally for a tree change. So it's bye for now, and hello next week to Edwina Farley.